My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Prior to that position, I worked in the MPCA's air policy unit, and so I'm very excited to have the opportunity to talk to you today about Minnesota's air quality. I'm going to be starting off the presentation by giving an overview of the Clean Air Act, federal air quality standards, and levels of pollution in Minnesota. After that, we'll be moving on to talk a little bit about the health impacts and the health costs, and then a little bit about what we might be able to do to improve Minnesota's air quality. So starting with the overview, the Clean Air Act, the federal Clean Air Act, provides most of the context for the MPCA's air regulatory program, as it's specifically designed to be implemented in a cooperative way between the federal government and the states. Today we're going to be focusing on federal air quality standards, which are known as National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NAAQS. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, is required to set these National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and they delineate a level of air pollution that is deemed to be safe for human health. Once EPA sets a standard for an air pollutant, each state has to develop a plan for how they're going to ensure that they meet the standard. And this plan is known as a State Implementation Plan, or SIP. And it contains programs, policies, and control requirements to ensure that air quality meets the relevant standard. If the state is in a regulatory status that EPA calls attainment, that is, if air quality is better than EPA's standard, then this plan, this SIP, is considerably easier, and it generally just relies on an existing air program infrastructure. The plan development is considerably more complex, requiring development of stringent emission controls if the state is in a regulatory status that EPA calls non-attainment, and is facing a situation where air quality needs to be improved to meet the standard. As I just mentioned, the standards are designed to protect human health, but EPA is required by the Clean Air Act to look at new science about the impact of air pollution on health so that they can be sure that their standards remain adequately health protective. So under the Clean Air Act, every 5 years, EPA must review their standards to account for any new scientific information. And this review process is quite long. One review process begins almost as soon as the previous standard is finalized, and EPA has a cutoff date for determining which scientific studies to include in their research and review. Since 2008, EPA has reviewed all of its standards, all of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and made nearly all of them more stringent. So there's been a lot going on in terms of the review of air pollution science. And when the standards are revised and made more stringent, even though our air quality may not be getting any poorer from a quantitative standpoint, we may see more air quality alert days or more concerns about our level of air pollution just because the science now is at such a place that it tells us more about the harm from that air pollution. EPA currently has standards for 6 pollutants, which are shown on this slide. There may be multiple standards for pollutants to ensure that they are that the standards protect both from short-term high levels of exposure and long-term more chronic levels of exposure. Overall, here in Minnesota, we've been doing a very good job at meeting the EPA standards and ensuring healthy air for our citizens. We do have some concern about our current levels of ozone and especially fine particles pollution, where we think we may have a risk for exceedance. We're focused on these two pollutants, and these two pollutants are where the bulk of our presentation will focus today because they are the pollutants where we are closest to the standard, where our levels in Minnesota are closest to what EPA says is health protective. In addition, they are also the pollutants where the most additional scientific information on the health impacts is emerging, so they're most likely to be revised downward. We actually saw this just in December of 2012 when EPA made their standard for longer-term exposure to fine particles more stringent. We expect EPA is currently in the process of reviewing their standard for ozone, and we expect that they will propose a new standard in 2013 and finalize that in 2014. And finally, these pollutants have some important characteristics that would make regulating them in the kind of plan that we have to submit to EPA if we were to happen to exceed the standard and be deemed non-attainment much more difficult. With our pollutants that we've had to deal with in the past, something like SO2, we've usually been able to identify just a small number of sources, and they're large permitted sources, and so it's fairly easy for us to point to where the problem is and control that. However, with ozone and PM2.5, because they have components that are formed from atmospheric reactions of other pollutants, and because those precursor pollutants come from a wide range of sources and mix together over a wide geographic area, resolving a problem of non-attainment, should it occur, would require looking at a very broad swath of sources over a big area. In particular, reducing the levels would require us to look beyond the permitted point sources that we usually deal with at the MPCA to the whole mix of contributors to our air pollution, including smaller, widely dispersed sources, mobile sources, and other things that are sort of outside our current regulatory structure. In developing a plan, if we were to exceed the standard, the MPCA would have to look at regulatory requirements for those sources. Before we go any further, a little quick note that although we talk in particular about fine particles being, in the regulatory sense, as if it's one distinct pollutant, as if it's just one thing, it's actually a very complex mixture of other pollutants that just happen to be little particles. And they include both ones that are directly emitted and those that are formed from atmospheric reactions of other pollutants, which are known as secondary. And in addition to being part of the mix of fine particles that we're concerned about, some of these particles might have additional characteristics or additional impacts. For instance, you can see here there's carbonaceous particles. One subset of these are black carbon, which are also a potent greenhouse gas. And the portion labeled other here can also include metals, which are also of a concern. So even though we talk about it that it's just one pollutant, it's actually a very complex mixture. And one interesting area of emerging science is research on whether every particle is the same in terms of human health impact or whether some might have a more detrimental impact than others. So how do we know in Minnesota what our levels of pollution are and where do we stand in relation to the federal standards? We use two tools for this, monitoring and modeling. Our monitoring data directly measures the pollution level in our air, and it's used to determine our current level and where we are in relation to the standard and whether we're in attainment or not. We can also use it to look at trends. But it cannot tell us exactly where that pollution is coming from. We use models to predict future pollution levels based on emission changes in particular sources to help direct policy decisions and to estimate future levels of pollution in comparison to air quality standards. And then if we happen to go on to non-attainment, we have to use models to show EPA that whatever controls or programs we put in place will actually result in us meeting the standard in a future level or future time period. So now I'm going to just talk a little bit more about monitoring data. We have monitoring networks dispersed across the state, though to be fair, we don't get data from every single place. Just as an example, this map shows the monitors that contribute to our air quality index. So when you have an air quality alert, it's pulling data from these monitors. So you can just see where sort of where they're dispersed across the state. And we have different monitoring networks located in different places. As an example of what our monitoring data can show us, this is the trend in our key pollutants, our fine particles and ozone, over the past 10 years. You can see the peak in fine particles in 2010 that really raised a lot of our concern about our levels of fine particles. And you can also see that we've had a slight uptick in our ozone over the last 10 years. To get more into that, these are our current Minnesota ozone levels between 2010 and 2012. EPA requires us to look at our data over a three-year averaging period, so this is the three-year average of the data. The red line is EPA's current federal standard of 75 parts per billion, which they set in 2008. So we look fairly good compared to that standard. However, with the emerging science in EPA's review, it looks like they're considering making the standard more stringent and putting it at a level somewhere between 60 to 70 parts per billion, which is shown in the yellow box, which would be a non-attainment issue for large portions of the state if they were to choose the lowest level. but it would also be a problem for a lot of the country. If they were to set it at 60 parts per billion, only the areas in light blue would meet the standard. You can see that the Northeast and California have a lot higher levels of ozone than we currently do. This is our, this is three-year averages of our daily fine particle numbers. We say design value, because that's the term that EPA uses that says use the three-year average and describes how we have to average the data. So this is 2008 to 2010, and then rolling forward 2 years, so that the green is our most recent data, 2010 to 2012. And I will caution that the 2012 data is not fully quality assured at this time, but we expect the numbers will be pretty stable. So it does show good improvement, particularly in our areas of concern over St. Paul, which you can see were over the previous standard, again, the red line, a couple of years ago. Do we know why this is happening? Well, some of it is clearly weather patterns. We are highly influenced by meteorology. In 2009 to 2010, that winter, we had several inversions, they're called, and meteorological phenomena, and they are particularly notable for creating days with high fine particles. And so we think that's part of what was contributing to that exceedance. But of course, our own pollution is also a big part. The highest daily fine particle concentrations are found generally in the western U.S., but a wide area of elevated fine particles are also located in the Northeast and Great Lakes states. So, and you can see that in general, most of the country does fairly well on this measure. This is our data, again, for the last three-year averages for our annual fine particles. This is the standard that's designed to protect from longer-term exposures. The previous standard, the daily standard, is designed to protect from acute short-term exposures. It's based on looking at a whole year of data. And generally, my understanding is that studies seem to show that this annual standard is more important for protecting human health. This is the standard that EPA just lowered, moving it from a level of 15 micrograms per cubic meter to 12 micrograms per cubic meter, as shown on this slide. We have been close to or above 10 in recent years, but our data is currently hovering around 8.5 to 10. So generally, for the moment, we're looking okay here. Annual average fine particle concentrations in Minnesota are actually among the lowest concentrations seen across the U.S. This is looking back 2009 to 2011. We are seeing a gradual downward trend in this in Minnesota. However, although we're seeing this some improvement in our key pollutants, we at the MPCA remain concerned about the potential for Minnesota to go into non-attainment with the standards for ozone and PM2.5. And non-attainment, I'll admit, is kind of a funny word because it leads you to talking in a lot of double negatives, saying our goal is not to be in non-attainment. So our goal is attainment. If we were not to be in attainment, it would likely be because of a situation where air quality standards became more stringent. But it could also be because of changing weather patterns or if we were to have an increase in our pollution. We're concerned about the potential of non-attainment for many reasons. First, as I mentioned earlier, it would require the imposition of controls on a wide range of sources over a broad geographic area. This includes stricter requirements on point sources that would increase permitting time and complexity, and there would be other regulatory requirements, many of which are set by the federal government. Costs are another major concern. Prior estimate of the cost of the controls needed to meet the non-attainment requirements have been quite high, in the hundreds of millions of dollars annually. And of course, we want to stay in attainment because, by definition, if we were to go into non-attainment, it would mean that the area's level of air pollution is high enough to cause adverse health impacts. Even without the threat of non-attainment, reducing air pollution, especially fine particles and ozone, has major health benefits. EPA has estimated that implementation of the Clean Air Act, so all the suite of programs under the Clean Air Act that reduce pollution, including meeting these national ambient standards, will result in trillions of dollars of health benefits annually by 2020. And much of this has come from reduced point source pollution. To stay ahead of the changing standards and to improve the health of Minnesotans, we need to continue to work to improve our air quality, particularly by facing the challenge of reducing pollution from smaller, more widespread, and mobile sources. So we hope to be able to do it voluntarily and working together with our sources rather than through the regulatory scheme that would be required in a state implementation plan. So that's kind of an overview of standards. The remainder of the presentation, we're going to focus on the health costs of air pollution and the potential benefits from reducing air pollution. So there are many different ways to estimate the health costs of air pollution. And they may come up with slightly different answers, and which you use depends greatly on the data available. But in general, this is the path that we would use to get to an estimate of the health costs. First, what is the relevant pollution level? So we would look at monitoring data. People could also look at individual exposure rather than a single monitor that, like we use in the regulatory scheme. The question is, what do you have the data to support? The second step would be, who is getting exposed to the pollution? What's the population? How big is it? Are there a lot of sensitive people, children, the elderly, the ill? Are we looking at a specific person or at the overall population? Then the third step, what is the health impact? So what happens when the person or the population is exposed? Do they have an asthma attack? Do they have a heart attack? Are there lost work days? Are there lost school days? Do they go to the doctor? Can we predict what will happen, or do we have the data to show what happens? And finally, the last piece would be, what is the economic value of the health impact? And this could be done in two ways. You could look at a strict monetary or financial cost, such as what is the cost of a hospital bill for a heart attack? Or we could take a wider look at the total economic cost, not just the hospital bill, but lost wages, pain and suffering, lost productivity, etc. And in addition, there are health impacts that we just don't have the tools yet to quantify. So there are adverse impacts from air pollution that we can't put a monetary value on. But we have done our best to try to make some estimates around the costs of the human health impact from air pollution. And there are two ways of doing this estimate that are going to be presented here today. And so first, my colleagues from the Minnesota Department of Health are going to present on their study, which did direct observation of patients in the Twin Cities. And then my coworker David Bale is going to speak about some MPCA estimates. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Jean Johnson from the Department of Health.
As you're setting up for this next segment, one of the kind of basic questions here is, when the standard for ozone was reset in 2012, was that a standard recommended by the scientific panel, or was it a compromise standard, which is what we've often had in the past?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my recollection is that when EPA redid the fine particle standard in December, that the Scientific Advisory Committee had recommended a range between 11 and 13 micrograms. So I think that 12 micrograms that EPA chose was right in the middle of the range.
Thank you. That's not always been the case. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jean Johnson. I work with the Minnesota Department of Health in our Environmental Epidemiology Unit, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk about a study that we completed recently in collaboration with research scientists at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and a medical researcher in Rochester with the Olmsted Medical Center Rochester Epidemiology Project. Our Environmental Epidemiology Unit is located in our Chronic Disease Division. We focus on the study of chronic diseases and their environmental risk factors, and we track data for the purposes of informing public health action and policy, similar to the work we're doing here today. So let me just start by mentioning the study that we did. This was an EPA-funded study. It focused on particulate matter, and I think Catherine has explained very well sort of why we are particularly interested in fine particles, or PM2.5. These are the ones for which there is a wealth of evidence pointing to health impacts from particulate matter. These particles are extremely small, as you can see from this illustration. Not only are they inhaled deeply into the lung, they can actually cross into the bloodstream, and so they are known to impact both respiratory diseases as well as cardiovascular diseases. Just a couple of sort of background comments about some things that we know about the public health impacts of particulate matter, and then I'll talk just specifically about the study we did here. One of the important points is that these health impacts are measurable, directly measurable with human health data. And we've known this for many years. If you're familiar with the incidents in the 1950s in London Fog and Dunora, Pennsylvania, you know that we've been looking at deaths as an outcome for PM for many years. Over the last 20 years, the epidemiology studies in this area have expanded tremendously. We now have a large body of evidence looking at lower levels and other impacts. But some things that we do know is we do know there's an increased risk from short-term exposure of premature deaths. That increase of 0.4 to 1.5% might look like a very small number, but it's remarkably consistent across multiple city studies. And, of course, you have to keep in mind that there's a very large vulnerable population impacted. So that makes the public health impact larger. There's about a 5 to 15% increase in risk from long-term exposure for many years. The strongest effect that's observed in the literature is for cardiovascular or heart diseases related to PM. In addition to the vast literature that we see with adults, there are also increasingly studies looking at children. There have been some effects in studies on lung development and, of course, asthma exacerbations measured in hospital and clinic visits. These effects are observed even at the low levels that we still see today. And there are also increasingly studies looking at traffic as another potential risk for asthma and heart disease exacerbations. Catherine mentioned, and I will repeat this point as well, it does make a difference how large the vulnerable population is, who is impacted. We all know that people with pre-existing heart and lung diseases are most vulnerable to these impacts. This is just to give you an idea. In Hennepin and Ramsey County, the American Lung Association released a report called The State of the Air 2012. These are some of the numbers of the size of the vulnerable population we're talking about. Hennepin and Ramsey County alone, we're looking at 26,000 children diagnosed with pediatric asthma, 97,000 adult asthma, 54,000 chronic bronchitis, 22,000 emphysema, 402,000 with diagnosed cardiovascular diseases. So this is the size of the population most impacted by air pollution.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Kahn. It
seems to us that not looked at the data to the extent that you have, that there's a disproportionate effect upon children of color in terms of the, is that the kind, you know, specifically one of the areas that I'm concerned with, and I know my colleague sitting up in front is very concerned with, is the North Minneapolis and the issue of adding additional pollutant activities into that area. Is do you keep that kind of data too in terms of the economic status and the racial composition of the affected groups?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, we do track with our asthma program tracks the occurrence of asthma, and to the extent that we, with our available data, which is somewhat limiting, we do try to look at any sort of disparities that we can see in the data. So we rely, for example, on hospitalizations data, which unfortunately does not provide us with racial and ethnic information. So to get that information, we need to look at other data sources. But we can look at geography. We have zip code, for example, with our hospitalization data. So we can look at rates by zip code, by county, and we can see geographic disparities like the one you're describing. So we do know that those occur. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative, did you have a follow-up?
I'll let Representative Mallory follow up. I think he's probably.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard statistics last fall that I thought came from your department that indicated that some schools in inner cities had 11 times the asthma rate as some of the suburban schools. I thought it was your department. Is that from some other department, or is that?
Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with those statistics, so that may have come from another department, but it may just be something I'm not familiar with.
That would be a good thing for us to follow up on if we could after this hearing.
Yes, I will make a note to do that. All right.
If you'd like to continue.
All righty. This is another way we look at the health effects from particulate matter is this pyramid. And I think what this demonstrates really some of the things that we know about the health effects of PM. I mentioned death as the most severe effect, but probably the smallest in numbers. Where the really larger numbers come in is as you move down this pyramid. If we count hospital admissions, emergency room visits, the numbers increase. If we were to count clinic and doctor visits where we can get that information, the numbers are even larger. And in some situations where we can actually measure medication use, symptoms, lung function changes, immune cell responses, and heart rate variability, these are sort of the finer sorts of measures that studies are able to look at. Most of our work, because this data is most accessible to us, we can get death data from death certificates, hospital admissions we get from the Minnesota Hospital Association through the health department, and as well as emergency room visits. And so these are the data that we're particularly studying in our project. This project, as I mentioned, was funded by the EPA, a program called STAR, Science to Achieve Results. The goal for EPA was to develop new indicators for measuring and tracking the impacts of outdoor fine particles on public health in Minnesota. EPA was particularly interested in any indicators that we could develop that would evaluate progress from air pollution reduction policies. They want to see if we can track progress and change over time as a result of policies being implemented. So we were looking particularly at the time period from 2003 to 2009. We were inspired to do this work during this time period because of a number of pollution reduction initiatives that were going on here in the Twin Cities, Minnesota, and nationally aimed at reducing particulate matter. These included the MERP project, Minnesota Emissions Reduction Project, a voluntary project in Xcel Energy program, which was converting two of the power plants here in the Twin Cities from coal to natural gas, and one was undergoing major improvements. It also, locally, we were looking at projects like the diesel retrofits going on from Project Green Fleet, some other local initiatives like anti-idling, Go Greener Initiative Met Council, and some major national initiatives at that same time period were the ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel rule going into play, as well as heavy-duty diesel regulations. So in our project, what we wanted to know was, can we actually measure, using local data available to us, the public health impact of all of these changes going on during this time period? Would these policy changes result in measurable reductions in population exposure? And in turn, would those measurable reductions also result in measurable changes in adverse health outcomes? That this was sort of our challenge. And so it was a methodological study. PM data we were able to obtain from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And as I mentioned, our measures of health outcomes, respiratory diseases, cardiovascular disease, hospitalizations, and deaths came from death and hospitalization data available to the health department. Population exposure data for the Twin Cities. We focused on the Twin Cities for this part because this is where we had the best available monitoring data. There are multiple daily continuous monitors. We looked at daily 24 averages, and we averaged over 6 monitoring stations. From that, we were able to calculate a daily PM exposure for the population living in the Twin Cities over that period of time from 2003 to 2009. In addition to looking at Minneapolis-St. Paul 7-county area, we also had in the study Olmsted County because I mentioned we had a partner, research partner at Olmsted Medical Center with the Rochester EPI project, and if there's time, I'll talk a little bit about the work that we did in that particular county. We looked at 2 different data analysis methods. Again, this was a methodological study. We looked at time series and case crossover. These are 2 ways of statistically looking at that relationship between the exposure and the health outcome. And just very briefly, case crossover study is essentially a case control study in epidemiology. It looks at a hospitalization as, say, a health event day, and we compare that case to that what that person would have been doing or their exposure on the non-event days. So essentially, the individual serves as their own control on it. This works very well with when we have acute exposures where an event occurs within days of an exposure, and that was what we were looking at here. So we're studying whether pollution levels are higher on the days immediately preceding a hospitalization event and comparing that to what pollution levels would have been on days when that individual did not experience an event. So this is called a case crossover study design, and it's been used in a number of the epidemiology studies. As I said, it's effective for these sorts of acute short-term events. It does not study long-term health impacts, however. The other method we looked at was time series. This is a daily count of hospitalizations being modeled against daily air quality values over time. Again, this is 2003 to 2009 we were looking at. This modeling approach also, we were able to account for temperature, humidity, holidays, flu epidemics, and days of the week. In this particular analysis, it's not looking at individual level data, which case crossover does. So I'm going to jump quickly to the results. As I mentioned, the one I'm going to be sharing is the results for respiratory hospitalizations. This was the area where we saw results that were statistically significant. We also saw good agreement with those two methods I just described, case crossover and time series. They were very consistent and comparable. So we feel most confident in these results for respiratory hospitalizations. We did measure a statistically significant association, and then from that we can actually calculate the amount of hospitalizations that are attributable to PM during that time period, 03 to 09. We calculated approximately 2% of the total respiratory disease hospitalizations in that time period attributed to PM2.5 above background level, and this is also true about 2.3% for chronic lower respiratory diseases, 2.3% for asthma. From that percent, we can then calculate an average hospitalizations per year that we would expect had occurred during that time, again, attributable to PM. And from that number and knowing what the average cost of a hospitalization is, we were able to calculate hospitalization costs. So we estimated hospitalization costs from 03 to 09 due to PM for total respiratory disease of about $1.6 million. $700,000 for CLRD, $270,000 for asthma. Some important findings, considerations. The results were somewhat conflicting, although we found statistically significant effects with respiratory disease. We did not find statistically significant effects for cardiovascular. This was unexpected because in the national and really the global studies, cardiovascular effects are quite strong. So we're not sure why we did not see these. We don't know if it's because the flu levels were lower, or perhaps it's a difference in the vulnerability of our population here. Perhaps it's we'd like to think we have great access to health care. A number of factors might explain that. We may simply not have had the numbers and the statistical power to find it. Another interesting observation, actual Medicare costs have increased significantly. That's probably not a surprise. We would not want to use actual cost as an indicator of the air pollution impact simply because medical costs have increased. Continuous monitoring locations. This study worked very well in the Twin Cities because we have a number of continuous monitors here in the Twin Cities. It would be very difficult to extend this method to the state as a whole, using that data because of the limitations on where these monitors are located. To look at this as in the state as a whole or in other geographic areas, we would need to use modeling data, which Catherine described previously. We know these results underestimate the true burden on health because, as I mentioned earlier, we're only looking at a piece of that pyramid. We're not capturing some of those underlying effects that are not being counted here. We're recommending a continued evaluation of this method using more years of data. We think this would strengthen our analysis. And we also would like to compare how this method works with a more with the predictive model that you'll be hearing about next, the BenMet model. And I don't know if time permits. Oh, I'm not. It's not progressing forward for some reason. How are we doing on time? Are we okay? Madam Chair, I have a couple more slides.
Why don't you go ahead with those? Go ahead.
Right. I wanted to mention the piece of the project that we did in Olmsted County with the Rochester Epidemiology Project. This was a unique aspect of our study because the Rochester Epidemiology Project links together medical records for all residents of Olmsted County from their primary sources of health care. This gave us unique access to health clinic records, which are actually usually difficult to get hold of and to study. We see medical records from multiple institutions. It archives historical medical records. And it's geographic population based. It's not based on a health plan. So we essentially have medical, able to look at clinic visits for all residents in Olmsted County. And I should also mention they all, when they come into the clinic, they give their consent to be a part of the Rochester Epidemiology Project. So through this project, we were able to look at asthma exacerbation data. We were looking at all asthma encounters from 2000 to 2010. We defined exacerbations as an inpatient hospitalization, emergency department visit, but also, this is the unique piece, three or more outpatient visits within a two-week time period. This is, again, because we had access to the clinical records. In this case, we were looking at traffic as a measure of exposure, and we used traffic data from the Department of Transportation. We were able to estimate with our partners at the Pollution Control Agency annual average daily traffic for road segments from commercial diesel and light-duty vehicles. This can then be mapped, and we can assign traffic density and traffic values to each of the individuals in the study. We conducted a multivariate analysis looking at age, sex, a poverty indicator, because we know that poverty is a strong risk factor for a number of health outcomes, including asthma. We were able to look at three different measures of traffic. And just very quickly, I will click through these results. Again, this confirmed poverty as a powerful predictor of asthma, but it did also, even adjusting for poverty, age, and sex, we did find a statistically significant association with proximity to traffic, living in proximity to traffic, and asthma exacerbations. Odds of any exacerbation increased 8.2% for every unit increase in traffic density. And we saw similar results with our other traffic measures as well. I want to just conclude by acknowledging our partners, again, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Rochester Epidemiology Project, and the Department of Transportation, all of which provided data to this study. We hope to continue this work forward, even though our EPA funding has ended for this project, our Environmental Public Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program. We hope to be able to continue this work, looking at these methods, collecting data, and looking at these associations. And I have a couple of websites if you want more information. We can follow. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I guess we'll take just a question or two before we go on.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Dr. Johnson, going back to your slide quickly on the Twin Cities, the reduction initiatives, in your opinion, what effect has a blending of ethanol had on air quality, especially here in the Twin Cities area?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is a good question. I'm afraid I don't know about the blending of ethanol, so I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. I'm sorry. But I could certainly look into that if you like.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Would you like a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. On your slide for the Twin Cities Air Pollution Reduction Initiatives, could you clarify the heavy-duty diesel regulations specifically? What may be some measures in that, and is there a possibility that those might reach outside of the metro area, if it's diesel in general?
And I'm the epidemiologist, so I apologize that I am not the expert on the heavy-duty diesel regulations. I know there are some other folks here that probably could answer that question better than I could.
Let's see if we can get that information.
Thank you.
It is my understanding that is a national initiative.
Actually, there's some brand new studies on that too. So let's remind me to get those. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Johnson, I wanted to drill down to some of the data in the metro area. You spoke that you had zip code related data, and when we think about the geography of the metro area, you've got hills and valleys, and that somewhat conforms to zip code. When you find these results for the metro area, are you able to break that down and give us data that shows results by zip code, or are those samples too small for hospital visits to draw any conclusions on a zip code level?
Dr. Johnson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. That's a very good question, and I think you've actually correctly hit upon the answer. One of the reasons I did not, for example, present those results for Rochester is we did not find associations in Rochester. We felt that even looking at all of Olmsted County, we did not have enough numbers, enough statistical power, essentially, to see measure those associations. So you're right. Looking at zip code, we would have that same issue.
Thank you for the testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And next we have Mr. Beal or Bale?
Bale.
Bale. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bale. I am the Environmental Economic Analyst at the Pollution Control Agency. I'm here to present our analysis on the total public health burden, both in terms of number of health impacts and economic value attributable to current fine particles and ozone pollution in Minnesota. It's a slightly different perspective than what Dr. Johnson just presented from the Department of Health, in that instead of using local data on health outcomes and health costs, we take a more conceptual approach to assess the full burden on public health of current pollution levels. It's somewhat of a hypothetical exercise in that we could never eliminate all pollution, but nonetheless, I hope it's informative. We draw on peer-reviewed methods and models developed by the EPA for assessing the human health costs of air pollution. This slide presents an overview of each step in the analysis. We have used a set of models from the EPA. Dr. Johnson referred to BenMap. Where these models come from. These models systematically address the four questions of estimating air pollution health costs that my colleague Catherine showed you earlier. Here they are again. First, to address the question of what is the pollution level, we model both the current pollution level and the hypothetical pollution level if human-generated emissions were removed. This is the naturally occurring background. The difference between these two levels is the pollution attributable to emissions. Secondly, to address the question of who is exposed, we model this difference in exposure, again, between current air quality and naturally occurring background levels for each person in Minnesota. Thirdly, to address the question of what is the health impact of air pollution, we model the health impacts associated with this difference between current air quality and background levels. And finally, we address the last question on this slide, by modeling the economic values of those health impacts attributable to current pollution levels. For the current levels of fine particles and ozone, we have modeled air quality from the most recently available emissions in conjunction with several years of ambient monitor data. This allows for the most up-to-date and accurate analysis, as well as for full spatial coverage across the state for air pollution impacts. Now, to get the total impacts of current levels of air pollution, we compare current levels to naturally occurring background levels of these pollutants. We have modeled two different variants of background levels of fine particles and ozone. The policy-relevant background is the air quality levels that would occur in the absence of all human-generated emissions in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Alternatively, the Minnesota zero-out scenario is what we have modeled air quality levels would be if just all emissions in Minnesota were removed, but business as usual for the rest of the world. This gives us a sense of what Minnesota emissions contribute to the health impacts of pollution on Minnesotans. This slide just gives an example of the air quality modeling we are doing. It shows the difference between current fine particles air quality and the naturally occurring background across the state with all North America emissions removed. The darker areas on the map reflect a greater difference due to higher current ambient concentrations of fine particles. This is the same slide, the same type of map as the previous slide, but just an enlargement of the 7-county Twin Cities metropolitan area. Once we've addressed the question of what is the pollution level, the next question in the analysis is who is exposed. We use the most up-to-date data that we have, which is 2010 census data. This gives us a full distribution of population throughout Minnesota, including demographic data of more vulnerable populations, as was mentioned earlier, such as the elderly and young children. The next question is, what is the health impact of the pollution exposure? This table, which is somewhat similar to the list of health impacts that Dr. Johnson showed earlier, but this shows what the EPA has identified as the key health impacts of fine particles and ozone. While this is certainly not an exhaustive list of all of the health impacts of these pollutants, it does comprise the most significant impacts and those that can be reasonably quantified with the available epidemiological impact models and economic valuation models for addressing air pollution. This list also echoes the pyramid figure that Dr. Johnson showed you, with the most important or the most significant impact, premature mortality, at the top of the list, followed by the most important morbidity impacts or non-fatal impacts for these pollutants. It should be noted that in addition to other human health impacts that are not on this list and thus not a part of our analysis, there are also non-health related welfare impacts, such as materials damage, visibility, and ecosystem damage, which also don't figure into this analysis. This slide summarizes the method for quantifying health impacts from air pollution across a sizable population. What you see is a typical health impact function. This is the means to directly translate a change in air quality, which in our case is the difference between current levels and naturally occurring background levels, to the number of incidents of a particular health impact across the population. These functions take, as you can see in the equation, these functions take into account the baseline incidence of a health impact based on current levels before any change in air quality, the change in air quality, the exposed population, and finally an effect estimate, which has been derived from epidemiological studies that model concentration response functions to these pollutants. For fine particles and ozone, there are often numerous choices of health impact functions for a specific health impact. I looked to the EPA for recommendations to select choices that had the most credibility, were the most broadly cited, and were deemed most appropriate for Minnesota. The final question in our analysis is, what is the economic value of the health impact? We utilize economic valuation functions from the economic valuation literature to value different health outcomes. And just as the case for health impact functions, there are choices for which valuation functions to use in the analysis. Two predominant types of economic valuation functions are cost of illness functions and willingness to pay functions. Cost of illness functions generally just consider the monetary cost to resolve an illness, but do not attempt to place a value on the pain and suffering associated with a health impact with an illness. These are generally applied to value the less severe health impacts. On the other hand, willingness to pay functions, which are derived from survey data and are used to value the more serious impacts, notably premature mortality, these willingness to pay functions attempt to capture the complete value of avoiding a health outcome. They do not represent just the financial cost, but rather reflect how much people value avoiding a health outcome. The next slide here illustrates how willingness to pay functions work. So consider a scenario where there's a population of 10,000 people, and reducing pollution would avoid one premature death in that population, or an average risk reduction for each person of 10,000. Suppose that these 10,000 people were surveyed and that on average they were willing to pay $500 for this reduction in mortality risk. The value of that one avoided death can then be calculated as the $500 that each individual is willing to pay multiplied by the size of the population, which is 10,000 in this example. So in this case, that results in a total value of $5 million for each avoided death. Now, using these valuation methods, currently the EPA has determined that the value of an avoided death is about $8.9 million. This slide walks us through all the stages of the analysis for fine particles and for one specific health impact, premature mortality. First, the first bullet point is that we model the pollution from human emissions, or the air quality difference between current levels and naturally occurring background. Currently, for fine particles, this difference is between 2.5 and 16 micrograms per cubic meter, depending on where you are in the state. Then, based on the population distribution from the census and the health impact functions for fine particles and premature mortality, we determined that the annual health impact of human-generated emissions across the state is about 3,800 deaths. Next, we turn to willingness to pay studies, which again, as I explained, model the total value that people assign to avoiding premature mortality, which is, as I said on the previous slide, currently about $8.9 million per avoided death. Finally, we calculate the total annual economic value of premature mortality from human-generated emissions of fine particles to be 3,800 deaths multiplied by $8.9 million per death, or about $34 billion. I apologize if the slide is difficult to read. Hopefully you can see it in your handouts. These are the results for all the significant health impacts associated with exposure to fine particles pollution across the state of Minnesota. Now, the first two columns present the annual health impacts and associated economic values of all North America emissions. The top row of the results is the result for premature mortality, which I walked you through in the previous slide. The second two columns in this table show the annual health impacts and economic values of all Minnesota emissions. Now, there is uncertainty in every step in these analyses, which these results do not reflect. These results are our best estimates for these health impacts. In the supplementary tables that we have handed out to the committee, we also provide 90% confidence intervals around each estimate to begin to characterize this uncertainty. Now, I won't go into these results in greater detail, but you have them for future reference. You can see that by far the most severe impact, premature mortality, generally affects fewer people than the less severe impacts, but by far the economic value of premature mortality, which is annually in the billions of dollars across the whole state, effectively dwarfs the values of the other non-fatal health impacts, which all sum together value in the hundreds of millions. This slide presents the annual health impacts of fine particles pollution, but just for the seven-county Twin Cities metro area. Comparing these results on this slide to the statewide results on the previous slide, we see that a little over half of the statewide impacts of fine particles pollution is borne by the Twin Cities metro area. Here's a second illustrative example, with the single pollutant, ozone now, and a single health impact, in this case, acute respiratory symptoms. Modeling the difference between current air quality and naturally occurring background for ozone, we found that human-generated emissions in North America comprise of between 0 to 22 parts per billion, again, depending on where you are in the state. This difference between current air quality levels and naturally occurring ozone results in about 380,000 incidents of acute respiratory symptoms annually across the whole state. Cost of illness studies have found that the approximate financial cost of a single incident of acute respiratory symptoms to be about $60. Thus, the total annual value of acute respiratory symptoms due to ozone pollution across the whole state is 380,000 incidents multiplied by $60 per incident, or about $22 million. So here are the results for all the significant health impacts associated with exposure to ozone pollution annually across the state of Minnesota. Again, the first two columns present the annual impacts of all North America emissions, while the second two columns show the annual impacts of Minnesota emissions. Again, these are our best point estimates, and you can see on your supplementary tables the 90% confidence intervals we have calculated around these estimates. So overall, the health impacts of ozone are not as severe as the impacts of fine particles, but again, the most severe impact, premature mortality, affects far fewer people than several of the other less severe impacts. But the economic value of premature mortality, which in this case is about $450 million across the whole state, this vastly outweighs the value of the other health impacts. Here are the annual health impacts of current levels of ozone pollution just for the seven-county Twin Cities metro area. Comparing these results to the statewide results on the previous slide, we can see that a little less than half of the statewide impacts of ozone pollution is felt in the Twin Cities metro area. So summing up these analyses and summing up the Pollution Control Agency's presentation today, we can say that Minnesota's total public health burden of fine particles and ozone is substantial. The impacts of fine particles pollution are particularly severe, As I have said in my presentation, the economic values of these impacts are driven primarily by the economic value of avoided deaths. And generally speaking, reducing air pollution will improve the health of Minnesotans. So our next steps in reducing pollution will require looking at sources of pollution outside of our traditional regulatory structure. One of the ways we're looking at this range of sources is through Minnesota's Clean Air Dialogue, who will be speaking to you next. And this concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Very nice work. Are there questions from members? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see here. Mr. Bale,
yes.
I'm curious here. I found your presentation pretty interesting. And I'm just wondering, your last slide talked about reducing pollution will improve the health of Minnesotans. And I'm just wondering here, normally when you want to improve the health or improve something and by reducing something, normally there's some sort of a fee or a tax imposed. So I'm just wondering if down the road we're going to be looking at a carbon tax imposed on Minnesota in order to further the goals of what it is that you're looking for. And if that's the case, if we are looking at a carbon tax being imposed on Minnesotans, I'm wondering how far and fast will carbon taxes drive down emissions, and what would be the projected revenue, and exactly what would you need in order to achieve the goals that you're looking for to further improve the quality of life in Minnesota? Thanks.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm Catherine Usher. I'm also from the PCA. You know, at this point, this was really just a conceptual exercise to look, as we were asked to look at, is the current health burden of fine particles and of ozone. So it's not directly related to the carbon pollution. You know, as we look at policies for these pollutants, you know, we can do this analysis again, but I don't think we can address any kind of fee or tax or...
Representative Brenson, I think what we were trying to get an understanding of here was not a basis for a tax, but rather the health impacts on Minnesota citizens, and then just what they cost us as we are looking for strategies to reduce this pollution. So nobody has taken the steps that you are offering. Representative Clark is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry I wasn't here earlier. I'm trying not to be sick today, and I'm doing pretty well now. I'm so sorry I missed the first presentation, but I just have a question that maybe goes back. I was going back and reading some of the documents from Gene Johnson, too. And when you're talking about the impact on human health, I don't see anything here that really relates, except maybe back in Ms. Johnson's one thing about poverty. I don't see anything that really relates to disproportionate impact on certain populations based on race and income and poverty. And I know that that's, you know, it's not only a federal issue, it's a state issue. We do have health disparities portion of the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm just wondering, are you not looking at that at all in this? Or is it just that you didn't report it today? Or what about environmental justice and injustice in terms of the exposure to these contaminants?
Could you repeat that question for members as you answer it? Sort of.
I'm sorry, was I too far away?
Okay. Yes, the question as I heard it is that, you know, what I presented just presents the overall impact. It doesn't look at any distributive impacts of which populations are affected, particularly the more, I think you said, minority populations or more disenfranchised populations. And I know Dr. Johnson had some comments on this earlier. I will say in this analysis, I certainly agree that there are disproportionate impacts on certain populations, but this is just looking at a very broad scale analysis of across the state and is not taking that into account. I'm not suggesting that's not important, but this analysis does not address that.
Chair? If this analysis does not address it, where is it being addressed in the department?
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, we were asked to look to give this general overall picture, and so what Mr. Bale did were, you know, really use the EPA concentration response functions that delineate the health impacts that would come over a population and the EPA's estimates of popular exposure. So that that just wasn't our focus today. We were just trying to give this overall conceptual picture of the total rather than looking sort of piece by piece.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe that's a focus on another hearing. That's fine. It just seems like, you know, it is part of the whole picture to say that certain populations are more affected than others. I do have one other specific question about what you did present, which is cost of an acute respiratory symptom based on cost of illness, $60. When I think of people going to the emergency room for an asthma intervention, I don't know any place where they can get out there for $60. What is that $60 based on?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Clark. That is... there is a separate health outcome for emergency room visits, so this is the acute respiratory symptoms would be, if it involved an emergency room visit, it would fall under a different health outcome. These are, I believe, these are just the not very severe, just slightly troubling impacts that do not require further attention.
Okay, and then one final question, Madam Chair. One of the things that I know... at least in my city, the major cause of our children missing school is asthma. And insofar as these issues relate to asthma, it seems like that might be a really important part of looking at the cost, the health cost that you're looking at here. So I'm wondering, are you looking at that anywhere? Because educational costs, I mean, it's a lifetime of impact. Kids who get behind in school, you know, don't have the earning capacity. I mean, we can be very economical about it, and that's one way to look at it. But I'm just wondering, what about the impact on lost learning and therefore lost economic opportunities? And is that part of this at all anywhere?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, as you see in Mr. Bale's analysis, there is school absence is something that's looked at. In general, however, I think I mentioned in my portion of the presentation that there are health impacts and there are impacts from air pollution that just we don't have the tools to quantify. And I think that what you're referring to, while it's a very important impact, there's a lot of steps and analytical steps to get through from that those days of lost school to lifetime earnings and decreased economic opportunity that just I don't think are taken into account in the way that EPA does their school absence rates. So it's certainly an important one, but I think it's one of those ones that we have to look at qualitatively at this point rather than one that we looked at quantitatively specifically here. I believe, and David, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the school absence rates generally, the economic valuation is based on parents' lost work days.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have six more people on, and we want to make sure that everybody gets a chance and we have more testimony, but I do want the questions, folks to ask questions. Representative Mullery, let's just be as concise as
Thank
we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll cut it down to three quick questions, actually one question with three parts. I was just down at a conference in Iowa on the effects of environment on children and their brains. And I asked three questions, among others, of some of their scientists from the University of Iowa, and it was this. Don't we need to have these studies done on the effects of these on children rather than on adult males, which they're basically based on? The second question, don't we need to go under 2.5 and test smaller PMs and also what's in the PM? And the third question was, should we set our own state standards higher than the federal? Their answers were yes to all three. What do you think about those three questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I think you've touched on a couple of the key issues of the emerging science. As I mentioned, the EPA is... the National Ambient Air Quality Standards are meant to be set with what's called to be an adequate margin of safety, and it is designed to get at sensitive populations an adequate safety for those populations such as children and the elderly. And in addition, it's definitely part of emerging science for us to learn whether there is a different impact from very, very small particles, what we may call PM1 as opposed to PM2.5, something that's smaller than 1 micron, or particles, whether there is a difference from particles that come from different sources, different types of particles. And so I think you've really hit on those issues of emerging science. As I indicated, you know, the way EPA's process particularly works, they can't outrun the science. There's such a long time frame, and they really are working on what the established science is, and that's why they have the review process, so that they can continue to evolve the standards. In terms of a state-based standard, that's not something that we have at this point considered at the ACA.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers for your presentation. Air quality is important to all of us. And in your research on page 7, slide 3, you talked about how the average population is willing to pay $500 each. Is that on an annual basis? And so a family of four, you're saying, is willing to pay $2,000 annually for this? Is that how that's equated? That's the first question, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, it's a conceptual exercise. I mean, the willingness to pay kinds of estimates can be done based on surveys. You ask people, well, how much would you pay for this risk reduction? Or you can look at salaries. You know, how much more do people get paid in a riskier job? And that's how these estimates are done. And I think, are they annual?
This slide is just illustrating a hypothetical example. Mm-hmm. So I didn't mean to suggest that $500 is actually what the average Minnesotan or American is willing to pay. This is just to illustrate how the process works. This is, you know, we are talking throughout the presentation about annual health outcomes, though. So this, you know, and this is how much, somebody would be willing to pay over for a year's worth of reduced risk.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. The second question is, you talked about natural air pollution versus man-made, and I asked this question when we had a presentation on water quality as well. Out of curiosity, what percentage of the total pollution is from natural occurrence, and what percentage is man-made?
Yes, well, that, of course, depends on the pollutant that you're talking about. For fine particles, the vast majority is from human emissions. The what's considered to be naturally occurring background is less than 1 microgram per cubic meter of fine particles, and you know our current air quality levels are up to this the standard is 15 or 12 now. So the vast majority is from human generated emissions. For ozone, that's generally the case as well. I believe that ozone is somewhat more naturally occurring, so the difference between the current air quality and naturally occurring background ozone, naturally occurring ozone comprises a slightly higher proportion of the total ambient concentrations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one more follow-up. Total air pollution and Is air quality around the state getting worse? And then my second question is, life expectancy, is that going up or down?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, I think I showed in my slides, or previously, there's some bar graphs with the trends in fine particles and ozone. And what we've seen over the past few years is we have seen a good trend of improving fine particles. We have seen a slight uptick in ozone. So in general, I would say that things are pretty stable or slightly improving in terms of the air quality for these particular pollutants, in terms of what we monitor. That's taking into account that we don't monitor at every location of the state. In terms of health expectancy, I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3, your slide, the Twin Cities metro area air quality, it shows fine particulate has decreased since 2010, but the data that we seem to be getting today ends in 2009. When can we expect data that reflects what's happened since 2010?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, we do have data through 2012 for our fine particles. What we what EPA requires us to do is to look at a three-year average. So we have 2008, 2009, and 2010 are averaged together. Then we move forward 9, 10, 11, 10, 11, 12. So we have the data monitoring-wise, but in terms of the presentation about the economic impacts, it takes a very long time to actually get the emissions all developed in order to run the model. The basis of this is having an air quality model that predicts emissions all over the state, including the areas that we don't monitor. And it takes quite a while to build that emission file from our emission inventory, and we only do a complete inventory every 3 years. So I think our next update would probably be the 2011 data.
Another question, Madam Chair. On page 6, you have a map of Minnesota, and it says who is exposed. And for anybody who's familiar with Roseau County, in the furthest northern northwest corner of the state, there's Kitson, and then the one to the immediate east is Roseau County. The area that's in very light blue, which is north of Roseau along the Canadian border over to the Lake of the Woods, that's the Lost River State Forest, and there really isn't anybody that lives there. I'm curious to know where that data comes from. And then also on the same page, it talks at the top left-hand corner about, it has the map where it shows the breakdown of Minnesota particulate matter pollution degree above background. On your other slide on page 2, it talks about your monitoring sites. Those two seem to be in conflict to me. How do you measure PM in Kitson County, for example, but you don't have a monitoring site there, according to your slide on page 2?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, so the larger map is just the census map, just to get a picture of the population, and I would defer to your knowledge of that area of the state, but just to give that sense of where there's more people, there's going to be more adverse impacts. In terms of how we look at pollution in areas where we don't have monitors is through a modeling exercise where we know what the emissions are, and there's a very complex computer model that I would not even try to understand, but that basically predicts what happens when all those emissions are emitted into the atmosphere and spread out. And in the analysis that Mr. Bale did, it starts with that, and then it's also trued up against the sites where we do have monitors. So we look at where we have monitors and also have modeling data that match together, and then use that to help true up the model and make sure that we're predicting accurately the concentrations throughout the state. So we're using that computer analysis model to tell us what the pollution level is in that area.
Two quick questions, because we have three more testifiers, and I want to make sure we give them time. Representative Torkelson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will restrict myself to one question. I'm referring to the third slide on page 3, which shows national ozone concentrations and has a number of red dots on it that represent non-attainment. And I'm just curious about, since it looks like to me about half the country is in non-attainment, what are the consequences?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, those areas are required to do the state implementation plans for EPA. They're required to develop programs, plans, emission controls, and demonstrate to EPA that they will be able to reach the ozone standard by a certain date that EPA sets forward. And for ozone non-attainment in particular, the federal government mandates some controls that have to be put in place on some of the pollutants that lead to the formation of ozone. So there's a very complex regulatory structure that has to happen when there's non-attainment.
Representative McNair, do you have a question, a quick one?
Yeah, it is a quick one, I think, Madam Chair. It's a follow-up to Representative Hamilton's question. Mr. Bale, on page 7 of your, and I guess you could probably go to just the 7-3 slide. It's the same one Representative Hamilton asked you. I might have missed it, but this slide talks about what the economic value of health impacts are in the second part of your slide, 7.3, says on the average a population is willing to pay $500 each for the level of risk reduction. That's a value that you with backed up. Did I miss that? I thought you might have said you just put it in there. It really isn't fact-based.
Yeah, so again, I just wanted to bring put together a hypothetical scenario to illustrate how this valuation process works. This is $500. It is not a real value. That is just to help to illustrate how this works. I, you know, obviously chose a round number so you can, you know, do the calculations. In actuality, I don't know. I mean, the average willingness to pay across Minnesota or across the United States for a risk reduction to avoid death, I don't have off the top of my head numbers for that. It's something I can certainly look into and get back to you.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Mr. Bale, that's not what your slides say. I think it would have been more helpful. I mean, these are handed out. They're available to the public. This is actually, I believe, being televised today. So you just put some numbers in here, did some math, and took 500 and took it times probability and came up with a value that it actually is strictly a hypothetical, because it says on the average a population is willing to pay $500, and it puts a value on the death. This is all just a hypothetical. These numbers are just made up to be put on there, and it's a math equation that you've done. It's not actually fact-based, backed up, what you're doing, because this is, I was assuming the value of a life was 8.9, and if we each paid $500 a year for the family of four, we would reduce these. None of that's fact-based. You just put some numbers in and did some equations for us to look at.
Would you either like to respond? I think Representative McNamara, the point of this whole exercise is to see that there are health costs and to see that we do not want to fall into the little orange or red dots that many of the states do. We're not there yet. We don't want to be there. So we have two reasons not to to want to decrease our air pollution. One is so that we don't go over the federal standards, and secondly, because there are clear health costs. Now, whether you want to dance on whether it's $2 or $3 is not the point here, and certainly was not what we were asking the agency to do. We were rather asking them to give us a perspective, and they certainly have done a good job doing that, and I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, my name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the PCA. This one slide was just an example to show you how the model that David used calculates the health impacts, which were showed on other slides. So he picked $500 to show you an example that would be simple math. The results that were showed on all the other slides are based on EPA's modeling efforts, and they are fact-based, and they have a lot of documentation behind them, and it's the way that they have been demonstrating to the MMB how the effects of their regulations that they're proposing will work.
Thank you. We're going to hold all the rest of the questions till the rest of the testifiers have testified.
Ms. Poynthel?
No, we'll wait till the rest of the testifiers have testified. With that, Mark Lundgren from the Environmental Initiative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Lundgren with the Environmental Initiative. I'm the Director of Environmental Projects. And I'm here today to talk about Minnesota's Clean Air Dialogue. Minnesota's Clean Air Dialogue is a collaborative conversation among business, nonprofit, and government to discuss emerging air quality concerns in the Twin Cities metro and greater Minnesota area. We have been meeting for the last 11 months to discuss the challenges related to emerging air quality issues, specifically for ozone and PM and the potential of going into non-attainment, which as Representative Torkelson commented, has real and significant costs to Minnesota. We have gone through the process with 24 members of a cross-sector stakeholder group, many of which are here this morning, to identify what these challenges are for the state of Minnesota, develop a shared collaborative vision about how to address those challenges, and produce specific strategies and recommendations for implementation projects of how we can reduce emissions as a state collaboratively ahead of any non-attainment designations. Through our process, we have brought together six technical working groups to identify the full range of potential strategies that you could look at to reduce emissions. We looked at six different sources, some traditional source categories like point sources, heavy-duty diesel, and area sources. Area sources are pretty much anything without a big smokestack or wheels. They are buildings, commercial and residential, kind of small-scale stuff. And then some less traditional source categories like energy efficiency or renewable energy, or and renewable energy, residential wood burning, light-duty vehicles, and transportation demand management. The technical working groups, as I said, developed a full slate of proposals, and our formal working group used those proposals to evaluate and produce recommendations. So the outcome of our process is going to be a slate of recommendations. These are strategies for reducing emissions from each of our six source categories that the state can take now ahead of non-attainment. The categories for the recommendations are going to be education and outreach, kind of behavior change that the state can do to reduce emissions, and some incentive-based programs to incent emission reduction activities or install emission reduction equipment, and then some kind of policy and regulation fixes, all of which we believe could have a significant impact in reducing some of the pollutants of concern for Minnesota. So, as an environmental initiative, we believe in the power of partnership and collaboration. That's why we brought together this stakeholder group to look at strategies and develop recommendations. And we believe that through this process, we can leverage that collaboration and partnership to implement many of our strategies and recommendations to on-the-ground activity to help reduce emissions. And this is not just a pipe dream for us in Minnesota. We have a strong history of working collaboratively in public-private partnership to reduce emissions. For the last 8 years, Environmental Initiative has had the privilege of running Clean Air Minnesota. This is a public-private partnership co-chaired by the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Clean Air Minnesota's kind of biggest project that we have done to date is Project Green Fleet, which we spoke briefly about earlier. Through Project Green Fleet, we have retrofitted over 3,200 school buses for diesel emission reduction equipment. That is the equivalent of removing about 350,000 cars from the road if we're looking at fine particulate pollution equivalents. Because of our work, over 300,000 students in the state of Minnesota now have cleaner rides to school and have reduced exposure for some important air toxics. The state of Minnesota was kind enough to give us $2.4 million to seed Project Green Fleet. We were able to take that $2.4 million and leverage it with $7.1 million in private and federal funding to retrofit the school buses. And to date, we are about within 100 school buses of completing every school bus in the state, which it makes sense to retrofit for this equipment. So we're very proud of this program, and I think it's a great example of how we can utilize collaboration and public-private partnership to get some real good things done for the state. So with that, if there are no questions for me, I would like to invite up Mike Hansel, who is from Barr Engineering, representing the Chamber of Commerce, and Scott Strand from Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, who is representing Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and they're going to talk a little bit about why they have been involved in this unique partnership we have, They have been with us from the beginning, and they have been through Project Lean Free Ahead and Clean Air Minnesota.
Welcome to both of you. Mr. Strand, you're next on the agenda, if you would want to comment. And then Mr. Hansel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Scott Strand. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. MCA and the Chamber of Commerce have been involved in Clean Air Minnesota for nearly a decade. And I think it might be of some interest to the committee to understand why MCA got involved in this kind of an activity, why the collaborative approach struck us as being the right strategy. There are really three reasons. First, we'd seen the science. We knew that driving down ground-level ozone levels, and in particular, fine particulate levels, could have enormous public health benefits. But we also knew that the traditional regulatory tools under the Clean Air Act, permits, enforcement actions involving typically large stationary sources, could only take us so far. We needed things beyond what the regulatory approach would take us. And we also understood that if Minnesota were to fall into non-attainment, if the EPA were to make a non-attainment finding, that would be enormously expensive and enormously disruptive to both business and government in the state. So hence the opportunity for collaboration. The interests are aligned. The environmentalists and the industry people have the same goal of trying to reduce these numbers to avoid the non-attainment finding, and the collateral benefit we get from that is some significant, I think, advances in public health. So we've had some success already with Project Green Fleet. I think we have a structure we can build on with the Clean Air Dialogue, and we're hoping that these efforts will continue to pay off in the future.
Thank you. Mr. Hansel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Hansel. I work for Barr Engineering, but today I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce has also three reasons for being involved. I think first and foremost, it aligns with what Scott said. Our employees and their families, we live here, we breathe the same air, we want clean air for our employees and our families. Secondly, as Scott mentioned and as the PCA mentioned, the cost of going into non-attainment is extreme. The Chamber commissioned a study back in 1999 that it was several hundred million dollars a year on cost to businesses, both large and small in Minnesota, to be in ozone non-attainment. If you upgrade those figures to 2012 costs, it's more than that. It's several hundred thousand as well. The same could be true if we go into non-attainment for a particulate matter. A third consequence for business, again, both large and small, is that if you are in a non-attainment area, it becomes extremely difficult to expand your business, to grow your business, or for a new business to locate in the area that's non-attainment. You have to offset all of your incoming emissions, changing emissions. You have to put on more and better control equipment than most of your competitors have who are not in that area. And it really puts a damper on economic development. And so for all of those reasons, it made sense for us a decade ago, as Scott said, to collaborate on this. I think we've done a good job of that. We certainly don't see eye to eye with each other on every issue, but this is one that we do. And I think we've had a history of working together both in Project Green Fleet and some other projects, and we'd look forward to continuing that to prevent the non-attainment in the area again for the pollutants we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have a minute or two left for questions. Representative Barrett, did you still have a question? Okay. Anybody else? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hansel, I'm curious about, you talk about non-attainment and how difficult it is for businesses to relocate or expand in an area. Can you explain for me real quickly, how small of an area are you talking about? So when we're found to be in non-attainment, is that something that affects Ramsey County or all of Minnesota, or can you expand on that for me, please?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. It depends on the pollutant. For pollutants where there are discrete sources like lead or sulfur dioxide, the non-attainment areas may be very small, a portion of a county. for the pollutants that we're most concerned about, the ozone and fine particulate matter. The non-attainment area would be likely the statistical metropolitan area, or the consolidated statistical metropolitan area of the Twin Cities. So you're talking somewhere between 12 and 18 counties, including two counties in western Wisconsin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to love to dig down into this and then compare rural Minnesota to the metro area, but that's going to have to be another day, I'm sure.
I think so. Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Just a real quick one, Madam Chair. On the Project Green Fleet, you mentioned every bus. Are you talking every diesel bus or every bus, smaller bus, gas bus? Just exactly what do you mean by every bus?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is the diesel buses, and these are a variety of sizes, and it's those buses where it makes sense to do it. Some of the very old buses you can't retrofit with the new equipment. Some districts have new buses which already have the equipment put on, so they don't need it. So it's all of those buses that it makes sense to do, and it is most of the buses except the very old or the very new.
I don't see any other questions. Thanks so much for coming. Thanks to the Pollution Control Agency. I think there are going to be additional questions, but we have a base of information. I think there are some more questions about when citizens look at this, they want to know about bad air days and how many of those there are, and are they increasing or decreasing? And we will ask for those statistics later, but I don't see any other questions. Appreciate the PCA's work again, and this meeting is adjourned.